So first, let me thank organizers for giving me an opportunity to be here. It's great to be here. So I begin with the caveat that my talk doesn't concern anything about memory encoding or memory reading. But of course, we are working with glasses, which are systems which have intrinsic memory. And the question is how to now harness this the various properties or responses that we see in encoding and subsequent reading and so on. So that will be, that is the kind of discussion I would hope, maybe during the talk or later after the talk, and that will be work in future and so on. So I'm going to talk about memory response of glasses. So these are, this is work that has been done with different collaborators. Some of them would be here later, either for the memory program, like Chandan will be here, and then Kristen will be here next week for the suspension program, and maybe Ritu Kono comes later, and so on. Okay, so these are the three different things that I plan to talk about, and so these are different kinds of deformation. Ideally, I would have started with this and then gone like this, but since we want to ease into the shear banding, so I'll talk about the shear response at last. So I'll start off with the more complex thing, which is the active forcing. Then I'll discuss a little bit about cavitation, and then finally we go into shear forcing, shear response. So those who were there in Christina's talk last afternoon, so you already had some idea about active materials and so on. And so what we are concerned about is the glassy regime of these active materials. And so the model that we have in mind is a 2D binary mixture of dumbbells. In fact, this is a model that Leticia and co-workers are working, doing quite a lot of work. And the original model comes from the work of Walter Kobe, Francesco Shortino, and others. So basically, you take a bunch of monomers which are connected by springs, and then so this is a very dense suspension of these dumbbells of different sizes. And then what we additionally have is an active forcing, which is acting along the body axis. Okay, so there's overdamped dynamics of these monomers. So we are writing the equations of motion of the monomers and then evolving them. So unlike what Christina talked about yesterday, so there was a diffusion of the axis of rotation. And so basically there was a diffusion of the rotation. But in our case, there is no rotational diffusion. It comes spontaneously by the collisions of the monomers. And this is also what Leticia and co-workers have been doing. Okay, so if we go to the, so our control parameters, so we do overdamped dynamics, and our control parameters are the external, or the, so the intrinsic forcing and the temperature, okay? So since in the zero force limit, of course, there is a glass for this mixture, and this is this regime here. So if you go on decreasing the temperature, first there is a freezing of the translational degrees of freedom, followed by freezing of the rotational degrees of freedom, and this is a well-known thing. So then we switch on the forcing and see what happens. And the phase diagram is very simple. So you have a regime which is this active glass. So basically, if you are so at finite forcing and you are decreasing the temperature, I've pointed the arrow for the increasing temperature, but the decreasing temperature, you see that the diffusion slows down and you have the emergence of the plateau walls, glassy signatures and so on. And so this would be a path which is going like this, okay? And on the other hand, if you were at fixed temperature and, sorry, so this would be a path going like this. And if you were at fixed temperature and then changing the forcing, then of course you have the localization which depends upon the temperature, but then depending upon the degree of forcing or the more forcing that you have faster diffusion and so on. So this is very simple.
Could I just ask you to say a little bit more about how the forcing is
implemented?
Is it random? Is it
Yeah, so you start off with a random configuration, except that there's no net force. And you just, then the, just evolve the equations of motion. And there's a stiff spring. And so it doesn't allow much fluctuations of the dumbbell.
But they're expanding and contracting?
So the monomers are stuck by a very stiff spring, so the, that motion is almost suppressed.
Michael was asking about the
force.
How is the
force being used? The first thing I wanted to make sure that there are no motion within the monomer, within the dimer. But the force always acts along one particular direction that has been assigned at the beginning, which acts along the body axis.
There's a force along the body
axis. So, but they're being, when you, are they, they're trying to expand?
No, so that's what I'm saying. So the spring is very stiff. So basically imagine that there, imagine that there's a rod and it is just propagating in one direction. Mm-hmm. Okay, and that is the force.
You're just pushing.
Yeah, okay. Exactly.
So it's a constant force in one direction.
Yeah, exactly. Yes.
Along the long axis.
Along the long axis, yes.
And every one of these atoms is subject to the same
yes,
force.
Yes, exactly. Yes. And because of the collisions, the direction of the force will change locally. Okay.
So why do you not treat these as a
Yeah, then you have to, yeah, so it's a matter of the which equations of motion you want to solve, and this before I felt was the easiest thing to do. Okay.
And the density must...
It's very dense. It's very dense, so it's on...
change?
No.
That's not change.
So basically what we have done is taken a system which is... this dimer glass, and we have just applied this internal forcing on each of this, this system of dimer glasses. Okay, so this assembly of dimer glasses, dimer dumbbells has a glassy phase, and then we want to explore what is happening. And the question that we are asking, or asked in this specific context, is the active glass or the active limit here any different from the passive limit? Because as you see from simple single particle measurements, they're not much differences at all. So what we will do is we'll traverse along this line, which is an iso relaxational timescale. So basically along this path, the relaxational timescale remains the same. So we'll explore how this behavior changes as you go from one end to the other end, okay? And one way to look at, to quantify the variation is by via the Peclet number, as Christina was pointing out yesterday. So the Peclet number changes as Peclet 0 to Peclet infinity as you go along this path. Okay. So the surprising thing was that what you have in this active glass are these swirls. And this is, I'll come to this again in a minute. So you have these very large spirals that are present in the active glass, whereas in the passive glass, the swirls are not there. So this is the difference between the active dumbbells and the passive dumbbells. And since working in glasses, we are also interested where are the fast particles, where are the slow particles. And the fast particles are located wherever the vorticity is small. And the wherever the vorticity is large, these are the locations where more the slow particles are located. Okay, so and this is this population is continuously moving around and so on.
You have positive and negative vortices next to each other?
Yeah. Do we have that? We have one here, positive, one negative.
You must have.
I think listening to Christina yesterday, yes.
So this is I'm kind of confused. Yeah. What these what you're showing. So it's a 2D. System.
Yes.
And what you're plotting in the color is how fast the particle is moving in.
No. Okay. So let me explain. So basically, what we have plotted here are the displacement fields and the measured, or more specifically, the vorticity field. So the curl of the displacement field this is the colors are the strength of the vorticity locally. Okay. And additionally here, what we have plotted are where the fast particles and the slow particles. So we are asking, are the fast part, the location of the fast and slow particles correlated in any way with the local vorticities that one measures? And we are saying that the faster particles are more in this zone, and the slower particles are stuck in the wherever the strength of the vorticity is large.
And to characterize the iso timescale
yes.
line, mm-hmm. that links these two. That was from the mean square displacement.
You can take scattering. The density time correlation functions, and you can use the time scales from there. Yes, but you could also use the from the mean square displacement as well.
So is it clear that the time scale you measure doesn't depend on how you decide to measure it? I mean, because it seemed like depending on what event you were looking
No, so basically, so this is a iso tau line. So depending on what tau you measure, or the way you measure tau, the lines will shift. But what we are asking is, you have a specific tau relaxation time scale.
Yeah, clearly, if you change the quantity of tau, the line will shift.
Yeah.
But what I'm asking is whether the way you decide to measure tau.
Yeah, that is already known in the passive limit, that depending upon the length scale over which you are probing, your time scales will also change. That is already known in the passive limit, and it will just carry over to the active. And so there's no change in the way things happen. It's the same.
So what is relaxation? How do you measure relaxation?
So relaxations are just single particle displacements, in this case, whatever I'm showing you. And the single particle displacements, and you're asking how fast or slow this single particle displacements are happening. So you are decorrelating from the... So what you could do is either you look at this MSDs, or you could take some overlap function and the time correlation of the overlap, and you can ask what is the time scale over this overlap function will decorrelate and so on. Or you can take density-density time correlation functions. You could compute relaxation time scales from there, again at the single particle level. And this is the phase diagram that is plotted from the single particle measurements.
Jackie, sir, do you remember what's the density, the actual density that you measured?
I think it's 1.02 or 0.05, something like that, yes.
It's
Sir
Leonard Jones?
Yeah, this is Leonard Jones, yes.
Infraction.
No, it is, I think, 1.05, yes. Why?
No.
Did you use Leonard-Jones interaction?
Yeah, these are Leonard-Jones interactions, yes.
So what's this blue region in the phase state diagram?
Yeah. So this is the region where, so if you go along this axis, so first there is a freezing of the rotational degrees of freedom. So here you have a rotational glass. Okay, sorry, first you have a translational freezing, so you have a translational glass, and then you have a rotational plus translational glass. So you have the freezing of the 2 degrees of freedom happening at different temperatures or forcings.
And so you use translational and rotation diffusion according to Stokes-Einstein?
So what I haven't shown you, I mean, I can show you later on. So we have different correlation functions, one correlation function for the translation, one correlation function for the rotation, and you see where the find out where the time scales for each of these correlation functions. You plot it as a function of different temperatures, and then you see where each is diverging, and then that's how you plot these points on the diagram.
But you also use rotation diffusion.
No, we don't have any there is no rotation diffusion by hand. The rotation diffusion emerges by the collisions. Okay, so that's distinct from what Christina was talking about yesterday.
Okay. My question here was, do they annihilate the positive and negative?
We have not looked at this, but yeah, that would be interesting to look at, yes, in the future.
So I'm a little confused about the takeaway message about the two left mm-hmm. plots, because they both show vortex structure. It's just, it looks to me more as the string,
yes,
rather than any structure itself mm-hmm. that's important. So is that the message?
Yeah, so basically the vortices are more prominent in the active glass than in the passive glass.
More prominent meaning that if I scale up the lower graph, it might look a bit more like the upper one. I mean, what do you mean by prominent?
I'll just show you the measures.
Okay.
So what we measure are 2 different quantities. So basically, one can look at the correlations or the static correlations of the alignment of 2 of these vectors, or you could look at the correlations in the vorticity field. Okay, and so this is for changing Peclet number. So basically, one is moving along this axis and asking how this vorticity is changing and so on. So we measure the length scales that one can compute of this correlation functions, and what one can see is that the lengths grow by a sizable amount from the passive limit to the active limit. Okay, and there is a regime where there is a sharp. It's not a transition, but there is a sharp.
About spatial.
Yeah, spatial correlations are increasing. Okay, and so what you could also ask is So this is along an iso tau line. So basically, you're asking how that is changing from the passive limit to the active limit. And what you could also ask is what is happening in the limit of the extreme activity, or no thermal or a thermal limit. And basically, you're walking along this path and seeing what is the scale of vortices. And one sees that this kind of behavior, that the length scale of these vortices are increasing, or if you can say diverging as you go into the frozen limit. Okay, so basically, I think in the okay, let me come to the next. So there's a lot of discussion in the active matter community about this bacterial turbulence, and Christina also talked about it yesterday. So basically, in this very high activity limit or very high temperatures, you see a so if you plot again this vorticity field, you see a lot of structures that are there, and these are again similar correlation functions that one computes for this different. So this is actual bacteria. This is some model, similar to our model, and this is some theory that they had, phenomenological theory that they had constructed. And all these show this kind of similar vortical structures. And what they also talked about is some kind of turbulent motion because the energy spectra has a power law and so on. So in this case, one can-
Reynolds number is very low.
Yeah. Reynolds number is very low. And different from the turbulence is that you are not macroscopically forcing here, you are intrinsically forcing the system, okay? I think turbulence is a strong word because the only thing you are seeing is the spectra, the power law in the spectra. But anyway, this is how they sold it in the market. And so in this literature, what they find is that there is this limit where the forces go as 1 by F, or the time scale, or this length scales go as 1 by F. And what we are seeing is a crossover from this behavior to a behavior where it goes as one, we really don't understand the reason for this behavior, but there is a different kind of divergence as you're going towards the glassy limit, okay? So this is, there seems to be one crossover that is happening from this turbulent limit to one that is more near the glassy limit. Okay. So this was the case. So this is basically the decreasing F, how the structures of the display, so this is the displacement field. This is not the vorticity field, and this is the displacement field. And you can see how the displacement fields are changing as a function of time. And all displacement fields that I show are computed over this relaxation time scale. Okay, so if you look at instantaneous displacement fields, you will not see such structures, but you have to really collect the information over certain relaxation time scales, and then you will see this kind of structures and so on. Okay. So the question here was, so then are these vortices that we are seeing at the zero field limit, are the remnants of the so-called turbulence, or is it intrinsic to this kind of materials? And what I show here is that passive glass has been, in this case, the forcing has been switched on. So you're not coming from the liquid limit or the active liquid limit and going slowly going down in forcing. But in this case, what you have done, you have taken a passive glass and then you are switching on this forcing field. So it's a very complicated shear that you're actually imposing into the system. And there you also see this kind of vortices that are emerging. So I would say this is more of an intrinsic property of this kind of active forcing that you are putting into this quiescent glass. You had a question?
We also have sort of vertical structures that arise with this.
Yes, so that is a point that is there. I think in this bacterial turbulence literature, they have also looked at the 3D case, and they also see some structures, similar structures over there. Unfortunately, Christina is not here. We could have otherwise asked the thing. Yeah, so we are also interested to go to the 3D limit and see what kind of structures that would emerge if you have this very random local forcing being imposed into a glass. Okay, that I think is of interest. And so there in the last slide was basically, these are, since one of our collaborators is a biophysicist, he wanted to connect it to epithelial cells. And apparently in the epithelial cells, you also get displacement fields, which are very similar to what we are observing for this assembly of active dumbbells. So in some sense, this is a very minimal model that one can think about for this epithelial cell. So So I just play the.
But you don't have cell division, do you?
No, we don't have cell division, no, not at the moment. So that would be a next stage to think about and so on. Okay. So this is the summary of the talk. So, I mean, this part of the talk, basically, that we are interested in this kind of very.
What's the interesting problem in the context of?
In the context of what?
Tissue dynamics. Is there this?
No, firstly, do we have a minimal model to describe tissue dynamics? And so there are, I mean, so this is the particle-based model, okay? There are other models, like vertex models and so on, which are also, which are foam models, which are being used now into the active matter community. And one can now build upon these simple models and see how things progress. The other thing is, of course, that we have a lot of literature on the rheology of glasses, and then how does one modify those models? For example, how do you use STZ scenario over here, or how do you use kind of elastoplastic models here? So these are the questions that people are interested in, and some early work has started. So in a typical talk, I would bring this at the last, because the shear is the most simple shear is the most simple things to understand. And this is the more complex forcing that one is imposing on a glass, or a glassy system, or a jammed system, and asking what is the response of this jammed structure to this kind of active forcing. Okay.
So the forcing in either model or the real system, I assume we have real and model side to side. And so can I think of this in terms of something like your dumbbell model, or is it much more sophisticated or fundamentally different? I mean. So you know, you jumped to this, but I'm not sure whether I jumped off a cliff or taking a small step.
So what we have shown here is just a Voronoi tessellation. Yeah. And
same model.
Yeah, okay. It's a Voronoi tessellation.
There's no leap.
Yeah, so we haven't taken the leap.
So are you calculating the forces on each particle from the Voronoi tessellation with an energy function, like vertex, not like...
No. Just a simple particle model.
Okay, which,
yeah, no. Here we are just showing you the Voronoi tessellation, how it is moving, and you can see all these kind of T1 events happening in the Voronoi tessellation, okay? And, yeah.
Okay, do you see an effective
transition? I didn't stretch it that much, so yeah. So this is just, I think, some early modeling. So this is an interesting thing that people would... there are a lot of people working on this, and so in terms of memories, I think so the question of whether there's a memory of this large or this turbulent limit that can be imprinted into this kind of structures or not, this is up, I think, for discussions and so on. Okay, so I move on to cavitation. So cavitation, as we know, in liquids, it's quite well studied, and especially in the engineering community, but in the metallic glasses also, the people have noticed that there are failures that occur via formation of these microcavities, and there is some studies in the engineering community regarding the formation of cavities under mechanical forcing, but not much in the physics literature. In fact, I got interested into this problem because of a work by Michael that I came across, and so here Michael was looking at a copper zirconium glass. And what he was doing, he was expanding the glass and then waiting and asking when does a cavity pop up, okay? And so depending upon amount of dilation that he did, correct me if I'm wrong, depending upon the amount of dilation that he did, the waiting time for the cavity to pop up, there was a dependence on the how much of weight dilation he did. And from that, he computed free energy barriers and so on. Okay, so this
basically a sort of classical heterogeneous
nucleation problem. Yeah, exactly. And so when I looked at this work, so what I wanted to relate it to was the typical phase diagram of glassy systems, and so this is a typical phase diagram of a glassy system. For a Leonard Jones glass, and this is work that Srikanth had started off somewhere in 2000, and this was the group of Walter Kobe and Ludovic Berthier who completed or numerically did estimates for the this binodal, binodal and et cetera. And so if I have such a phase diagram of a glass forming system and I do this kind of expansion experiments, so what are the limits of stability in this phase diagram? Okay. And if I now do different paths in this phase diagram, what happens and so on. So this is the question. So the path that we take a liquid, we quench it to low temperatures, and then we start expanding the glass. So unlike Michael, what we are doing is, in the case of Michael, he was just dilating and waiting. In our case, what we are doing is we dilate by very small amounts. Imagine a quasi-static process where you dilate, you wait, you dilate, you wait, you dilate, you wait, and you ask, when does this cavitation event happen? Okay, and so the next question that one can ask is, does it depend on the rate of dilation and so on? Okay, and so basically this is the path that we are following in the phase diagram. So if you do such a process, what happens is that, so these are different temperatures at which we are doing the dilation experiment, and this is pressure as a function of the density. So I'm dilating, my density is decreasing, and your pressure drops, and it starts dropping, and then suddenly there is a jump, and this is where the cavity pops up. Okay, and if you compute the structure factor at this point, you can see that there is this diverging low Q regime, which tells you that there is this inhomogeneity that has been set up into the system. Okay. So, and this is actually very similar to a shock kind of process, that when the cavitation happens, there is really a burst of energy. And then once the burst of energy has happened, the system is completely static. Okay, so the compactification is very slow. So basically, here I show how the cavitation is happening. So here it pops up, and then the growth of the cavity is a very slow process. So because of the glassy matrix that surrounds the system. So then what we looked at is how this point at which the cavitation happens depends upon the rate. Okay, so how we control the rate? We control the rate by the time scale we wait after each dilation step. Okay, and so we have gone from 25 to 10 to the power 4. So if it's a very fast process, then you overshoot, similar to the stress overshoots that you see in shear experiments. So you overshoot, and then the cavity pops up. So basically, your point of instability depends upon the rate. So if it's a very slow process, and it pops up over here, and if you now relate these points to the, I have not drawn the line, but if you go back to the phase diagram here, so depending upon the rate at which you are doing the experiment, the cavity pops up at different points in the phase diagram. So basically, this line is shifting to the left depending upon how fast or slow you are doing the experiment. Yes.
You define a particular size beyond which you call it a cavity, or?
No, you really see a cavity. I mean, so there is no size, and these are very large simulations. So basically, a million particles are there. So around 100 in each direction in size. So, and the cavities are of the size of the order of 10 particle diameters or 20 particle diameters. So you can really see a cavity.
In the prior study, one of the things we had asked was, what is the critical size for the cavity nucleation? So we had put in like a hard sphere and then expanded it until it induced cavity nucleation. And the size ended up being like subatomic, like, you know, just a couple of angstrom radius, because it's just a void space. It doesn't have to be an atomic size.
And this is, you can look at how the cavity structure looks like. So basically, you have this, and this is a fast rate. So if a lot of cavities form, and these cavities grow in size, then they merge, and you have a percolating structure that forms, and you can see a failure is happening around that point. So depending upon the rate, if you are doing at a very slow rate, then you have one cavity, and that cavity grows in size, and that is the failure process and so on. Okay, so then to the next part. So then what I wanted to see was basically, if I now start compressing this cavitated solid, do I get back the solid that I started off with? Okay, and so this is one such cycle. So basically, you take this is the cavitation event that has happened and has continued to smaller densities, and then you start compressing at different points. Okay. So if you start compressing the solid at different points, you see that there is this, universal sort of path through which you come back. But of course, depending on where you do the decompression, you do the compression, you get into this path at different points or different densities. So basically, if I do start from here, I go along this path. If I go from here, I go along this path, and so on. So this is the pressure that we are measuring. This is, so I'm compactifying, and the pressure that I'm getting is along this. So this is so, the some kind of a, what should I say, the eventual. So if you, okay, I'll come back to this point later. So, and then you can ask is, if I go back to this point, do I get back the same structure that I started off with? And one way to look at this is to compute like structure factors. And what we see is that, so this, the green one is the structure factor that I started off with, or the structure that I started off with. And depending upon where I started my compactification, the low, there is some differences in the low Q regime. So basically there is a memory of the path that I have undergone when I go back to this point at which I started, okay? So there is a hysteretic process, but here we don't really recover the glass that we started off from. And these are the structure, of course, okay, if you compactify at some point, you lose the voids. So this is the point at which you have lost the voids, but still, there is a density and homogeneity that remains in this system.
So you take that compressed glass, stretch it again.
Yeah.
Is there a predictable place where it
So what we have observed is there is a softening. So basically, you don't need to go so far in order to cavitate. It can. So it will follow the green one, but it will pop up somewhere over here. Let's say.
No, but if I take the maroon curve, I come back.
Which one? This one. This one, yeah. And then you want to do it again, right? So you're asking whether you follow the green path or not. And I'm saying that you will follow the green path to a certain point, but then since there is already this certain inhomogeneity that has been developed, the cavitation would happen at a different place. Okay?
But not in any way related to where you started the Maroon curve.
No. Okay, so in this case, what we are so just a brief summary. So we are doing this kind of expansion and compression cycles, and we see this hysteresis kind of behavior, and of course there we are seeing structural mismatches and so on. And as Sri was pointing out, what happens if you do more cycles and you do a large number of cycles, what happens to this kind of structure and so on. So this is some work that is in progress and so on. So some ideas on these lines would be very useful. Okay, so finally I come to the shear. So as we know, so there was some discussion last night, and let me get back to that. So in this kind of materials, if you look at the steady state response, if you measure the stress as a function of the shear rate, so all the these flow curves that you measure are monotonic functions. So there is no non-monotonicity in this material. So if you there's a lot of literature on shear banding that comes from micellar systems, and there the shear banding happens because of a non-monotonic shape of these flow curves. So in these materials, there is no non-monotonicity, so there is no persistent shear band. So whatever one observes are transient shear bands, okay? And you could do this rheology either by applying a stress or applying a shear rate. And so these are experimental data from, so these are soft particles. So in the case of applied stress, you measure the strain as a function of time, and there you see that at large stresses, so the system has some elastic behavior, and then is a long time flow, which is defined by a single shear rate. And as you decrease the stress, there is a stress below which the system no longer goes into this long time flow. There is a creep regime, and the creep regime basically tells you where the yielding threshold is, okay? And or on the other hand, you could also apply a shear by imposing a shear rate, and this is what Michael was talking about. So in this case, you have a you measure the stress as a function of the strain, and you see that there's an elastic regime followed by the stress overshoot, and then at long times you have a steady state and so on. And there we are asking, and Michael was pointing out, what was happening to the system as you go through this path and so on. Okay, so we have done, so I'll briefly tell you what we have done in the case of the applied stress. So in the case of the applied stress, one can, I mean, and so this was a surprise that people hadn't done this in numerical simulations, and we are able to recover the kind of experimental behavior that I showed you just now. And the more interesting thing was when one looks at a microscopic scale, what is happening in the system. So these are maps of cumulative displacement. So basically I'm asking how much locally a region has displaced with respect to the initial state. And if you are at stresses which are larger than the yield stress, then you see the formation of shear bands, and the shear region broadens, and eventually it fluidizes. So this is at stresses which are much larger than the yield stress. If you are at stresses much smaller than the yield stress, this is where the region material is called supposed to be creeping. In the creep regime, you also have this kind of regions which have undergone plastic deformation, but these remain localized for very long. I mean, these are remain persistent forever. So basically in the creep, you don't see the complete fluidization of the system. Okay. So this was the case of a confined system, and now we have gone over to the case where the system is not confined, so you have really periodic boundary conditions. And in that case, what we get is that, I mean, the shear rate is a measurable quantity in the sense of it's a part of the equation of motion. And we can measure the shear rate, and there you again see this kind of, okay, this is the macroscopic behavior in the sense of ensemble averaged behavior. So you have creep, and above its yielding threshold, you get finite flow and so on. But if you really look at the single configurations, you really see the intermittent behavior, that you have bursts of stop, start, and so on, okay? And what we have been also trying to see is whether there are finite size effects or not. And so this is compliance. Compliance is nothing but the strain divided by the stress. And this allows us to bundle together all the curves. So you can see a region over which there is no difference between the different applied stresses. So basically, this part of the response is reversible. So if you switch off the shear from any of these points, you will recover the recover the glass. But if you are beyond some time, then you see a branching out of the curves. It depends upon the applied stress. And if your stress is large, then there is no, I mean, as you can expect, there is no finite size effects. But as you go smaller and closer and closer to the yielding thresholds, then smaller systems respond differently than larger systems and so on. And this is what you'd, So in this context, not much of finite size analysis has happened. And the question here is whether there is a critical point over here and so on. So this is work still in progress. Okay, so then I revert back to the case of applied shear rate. And so again, this is somewhat similar to what Michael had already talked about. So when you're applying a shear rate, you measure the stress. So the stress goes to a stress overshoot, and then it goes to steady state and so on. This is for different shear rates. So what we monitor are this, again, the single particle displacements. And so there plateau height depends upon the temperature. So the localization length for all temperatures are the same, for the all shear rates are the same, but eventually you cannot discern it because this is log scale, but you have different diffusion constants at the end depending upon the shear rate. So then again, we go back to the displacement maps, and this is the quiescent glass, and then as you start shearing the glass, you see the emergence of the shear band. And so this is the displacement field, this is the strain field, so the displacement field somewhat mimics the strain field and so on. And what we show then is that, so what we can do is we can map this to some ones and zeros, and then we can ask how does this more mobile region spread as a function of time. And what we show is that there is a percolation process that is happening. And so there is a percolating structure of these mobile regions, and this percolation happens at where the stress overshoot, or in the vicinity of the stress overshoot. And this percolation happens independent of the shear rate. So this is the basically typical analysis for the percolation. This is done for all different shear rates. And we started off with these geometries, and this is somewhat a remnant of what Michael had done earlier. And then we realized that this percolating structure is localized in these geometries because of the finiteness on one dimensions, but this finite size effects. But if you take a cubic structure, it spans the entire three-dimensional space and so on. Okay, so this percolation precedes shear band formation, and we have some finite size analysis, and this seems to be falling into the category of a directed percolation scenario, but this is still a work in progress, and I have not. And then there was one question that came up that whether this persists in the quasi-static limit. And we haven't gone to the quasi-static limit, but what we've been trying to do is going to first the thermal limit, so going to smaller and smaller temperatures. But we don't do it at zero temperatures because the choice of the initial state becomes very critical in what responses you see. So we try to be in the very small temperatures, which explains why these plateaus you see in the mean square displacements. But as you can see, as you go to smaller and smaller temperatures, the behavior becomes very similar at some point, and the thermal fluctuations are not that important in determining the response. And even in this case, we see the percolation scenario still there, so even at very low temperatures. So I think this still holds in the thermal limit. And what we have been also trying to look at is whether the structure that is being developing has anisotropies or not, then this would be more close to a directed percolation scenario. And it seems to be that this percolating structure does have anisotropies, and we are trying to. So here I show the different eigenvalues of the structure, and you can see that the values for the different eigenvalues are different, and so the structure is indeed, the growth of the structure is indeed.
In directed percolation, you should always have an absorbing state.
So the absorbing state here is the fluidized state. So the set of all fluidized states. Okay. So and then there were some recent experiments which seem to say that yes, this percolation scenario exists. Okay. So this percolation happens around a strain of around 0.08 or 0.05, I mean depending on conditions and so on. But the shear band happens after that. Okay. And so at large shear rates, you won't see the shear band. And this percolating structure would just, more and more such mobile sites would emerge, and the complete system would get fluidized. In this case, in these cases, you have a shear band that is emerging at a later time. So these shear bands could either be localized in the direction of the shear or even in perpendicular to the shear. But what you can see, and this was something that Michael and I were discussing a few days back, that there's still a lot of, it's not that only this zone there is mobility, there's also mobility that is happening in the remaining zone. And so it's not just a propagating front, there's also activity in the matrix that is also pulling the interface apart. Okay, so this is more pictures of how this fluidization happens. So, and the other thing that we have an idea that it's just there is homogeneity in the plane at where the shear band is happening, but it is not really the case. So as you can see, there are zones of nucleation of more mobility, and this spreads. So there is heterogeneity also in the plane where this shear band is propagating and so on, and eventually the system will get completely fluidized. Okay. What one can do is one can compute, one can look at this mobility profiles and so on, and this is some work that Jim and co-workers have been looking at earlier. And so you can ask how this spreads and so on. And what we could also look at is how the local potential energy behaves. I mean, the data is very rough, but you can see that, so this is what we started off with in the local potential energy. And then as this shear band pops up, the energy locally increases, and the energy of the matrix starts decreasing. And this is something maybe Srikant will have something to say about. And so eventually, and if you wait for long enough, then the system fluidizes. And the other thing was, if you look at the shear stress, it would seem that you have reached a steady state. But on the other hand, if you look at the matrix, the mobility, I mean, the heterogeneity is still there. And this is also seen in the potential energy is still increasing. And only when the system completely fluidizes, you see that the potential and the steady state in energy has been reached. So the steady state in shear is not the correct way to say that a steady state has been achieved and so on. Okay. So we have tried to quantify the degree of shear banding. So you can ask what is the degree of difference in mobility both in the band and in the surrounding. And so we do this just by looking at these profiles and computing how much of fluctuations are there and so on. And if I use this as a measure, I can look at how, so this is a map of, so this here in this axis I have age, in this axis I have strain, and then I have different shear rates and different temperatures. So basically what I'm trying to show here is that the degree of heterogeneity or the degree of mismatch in mobility between the shear band and the remaining matrix is highest when you are at small shear rates and low temperatures. And if you are remaining at the same temperature, then of course this becomes weaker and weaker as you increase the shear rate. And also again, if you're more aged, of course again the degree of heterogeneity is larger, and if you are less aged the heterogeneity decreases. And as you go on cranking up the temperature, the region over which you will see the shear band also decreases. So basically there is a window over which you will see the shear banding, and this window becomes smaller and smaller as you are going towards the supercooled limit. Okay, and this I think is an interesting observation. There is an idea that one can perhaps scale back everything with timescales, and this we have not tried yet. There is a intrinsic timescale by which you can scale out the timescale that you're measuring, and maybe all the scenarios can be mapped one onto the other. But we have not tried it yet. Okay, and this is the final thing, I think. Yeah, so then this was another question, and maybe Michael can talk a little about it. So you can ask now, how does the front propagate? And we seem to see that this is a diffusive propagation of the front. So we are just looking at how the width of this band propagates into the matrix, and we see that this seems to be diffusive. But yes, I think Michael has some other things to say. Okay, I'll stop here. And I mean, this is again propagation with respect to the age. So in this case, what we have tried to show is that, so it's not that the shear band is the only heterogeneity that one observes in when the system is yielding for the very aged class. There are, I think there are hierarchies of heterogeneities. And one such hierarchy is this percolation scenario that one identifies with yielding. And maybe there are more intermediate states before the shear band is developed. And this is, I think, work that we need to disentangle. So basically the aim of such work is, of course, there's a lot of measurements and experiments that have happened, but really identifying the transient states and understanding what are the transient states before the flow happens. This, I think, is still we need to understand. And yeah. Thank you.
Yeah, you said there were some experiments showing this percolation transition.
Yes.
But you didn't say much about it.
So these are experiments of Peter Schall. And so they're, again, they're doing an analysis very similar to us. And they're asking which are the fast particles, where are they located, what kind of structures they form, and they do an analysis which is also similar to us, and they claim that a percolation is happening.
It's on a colloidal glass.
Yeah, on a colloidal glass, and they compare it to a copper zirconium system, and also I think this is work of Stefano Zapperi, mesomodel comes from there.
Can just continue on into the discussion, or should we just sort of, after taking some questions, we stop, and then those who want to stay on for talking about shear banding can stay. But so one question that I would like to discuss at some great length is, this idea of a percolation transition is appealing. It's something that has been applied to looking at the localized diffusive transition in shear curling suspensions. And But it looks like, so we've been sort of looking at this with oscillatory deformation. And there, if the transition to yielding seems to be discontinuous, first order. And this, more recently, there have been sort of other analyses where people look at better annealed glasses, and they too, the transition seems to be first order transition. So the kind of precursors to yielding, which one sort of expects in a population type of picture, don't seem to be there. And the common feature between oscillatory deformation and the well-annealed glasses is that at the point at which yielding is happening, what you have are effectively very well-annealed glasses. The meaning of, you know, whether there are precursors to yielding, whether there is a perforation condition, seems a little bit unclear. That would be interesting to sort of try and understand better.
If it's direct percolation, you should also have two exponents, right? I saw you wrote new parallel.
Yeah, so we are trying the other one. Yes. Yeah, so the one idea of getting the perpendicular exponents was from the other length scale, and that's what we are trying to really extract. It's tough work. Not so easy. No, because in typical percolation models, you have everything, all your parameters are in control. Here in this case, it's an, in the sense you are controlling the strain here and you are not controlling the distance to percolation. So that makes life much harder.
So can I ask a question? I'm not sure I'm understanding it. When you say percolation, actually, what is the size of what are the size that you define? You said that you had the zeros and ones to convert to binary. Is it a local rearrangement that you define?
Yes.
It's a percolation of local rearrangement.
Yes. And the other thing is, you keep the information from time t equal to zero. It's not instantaneous. So because in the case of a thermal quasi-static, what people typically do is they are just looking at the case when the energy drop happens. Okay. So in this case, we are keeping the memory of the quiescent glass. So basically, you're asking relative to the quiescent glass, what are the regions of mobility that you're that
regions
you're
of mobility again?
Local mobility.
And can you do like a Voronoi and look when their neighbor changes?
One can do the such things, and there are other people who have tried this. Yes.
I think there's another way of thinking about percolation in this system. I know it's not the way you're talking about percolation, but you know, one of the things that's very clear, I think, in these systems is that depending on how you prepare the system, you see or don't see this sort of localization behavior. And particularly if you quench things really fast, then they don't form these localized bands typically. And so there's a possibility that as you quench the system, you form, you know, highly correlated short range, you know, high short range order regions, and that those themselves can, at some low enough quench rate, percolate through the system and create a kind of backbone.
Mm-hmm.
And that the reason that you end up with a shear band is that once you have such a backbone, once you break it in some location, then you have persistent shear in that region.
I think this is somewhat complementary to that. So you'd imagine that in the complementary part of the backbone, this would be the regions where the regions of plasticity would be, and that is what is percolating. So it's related to,
Are you using the word percolation in the sense that I used to understand it?
In what sense?
That's hard to answer.
Percolation means you have some sort of an object or maybe even a vacancy, and you stimulate the system perhaps by the temperature, and it moves, it sort of diffuses around. And that's what I think of as percolation, and I'm not sure. I think you're using it in a more general sense here. But
Look, I just don't understand a whole lot of things you're doing. What tells you where that shear band is going to occur?
We don't know, and I tell you, I mean, this is something. No,
the Michael's simulations from 10 or 15 years ago.
No, I think, in fact, I mean, this is something I was telling Michael later on, that it is sometimes even difficult to predict where it would happen, because thermal fluctuations might lead to the localization happening at a different place and completely in a different way. And you could have horizontal shear bands or vertical shear bands, and this is completely a stochastic process. And the equations that Michael has at the moment wouldn't lead to such scenarios. So, but, and this is something that we observe.
I think that there was some slight perturbation that triggered it, and there was an instability that triggered it. And I just not seeing how that's happening here.
I mean, to some extent, things may look different depending on how well annealed the initial glass is. And I think typically, since these, as I understand, are produced by aging,
yep.
not by controlling the rate of quench.
Yeah, but we have...
They're not as well annealed as some of the other samples that have been tested.
So this thing...
Because I would say in the systems that we look at where we quench slowly through the glass transition...
So in this case, we have actually looked at both cases where... I mean, I'm just showing you the case of aged glass, but we have looked also the case of what you call the annealed glass. And the behavior is no different. And
I was comparing aged versus slowly quenched.
Yeah, yeah, slowly quenched. Yeah, yeah. So we have tried both.
What does
aged? Aged, I would think, means held at a given temperature over a period of time.
How do you compare the two cases?
I mean, you can look at the average potential energy per atom and the systems of the comparable density.
Right.
That way, you might be able to compare the structural stability of the glass.
Correct. But then, so aged
versus
annealed.
No. So one is a continuously cooled. One is a continuously cooled system, and the other is a quenched and aged system.
Well, yeah. I mean, I think by controlling the rate at which you move through the glass transition, you can get the system to a lower, to a more stable configuration than you can by aging it at a given temperature.
Yeah, but I think...
I think in the systems that we see that are very well aged, we do see a high correlation between the structure and where the shear
is.
Yep. So let me ask a question which comes from, I have to give a little bit of context. So we have an experimental system where we're shearing brand new material, so there's no temperature here, it's only mechanical excitation. And if we actually apply, we have a protocol where we apply a weak forcing everywhere in the shear sense, then we can totally suppress shear bands that organically would form. That's the context.
What do you mean by weak forcing everywhere? You mean it's on a sheared substrate?
It's on a substrate that's deforming half on it.
Okay.
And so the weak forcing comes from weak friction of the particles within.
And so you say that you can suppress any kind of shear banding instability.
Well, I don't know about any, but generically, we don't see shear bands in that apparatus. And so then so here's the question, I guess, is suppose that you took measurements of this sort and applied an arbitrarily small kick in that was at the local affine shear, would that be sufficient to suppress the bands?
That's typically how we...
And that's the SLODD.
Yeah, I mean, that's typically how...
But a very weak, I mean, how weak, how strong do you need to suppress the shear bands?
So this gets to the shear rate. I mean, you showed some data clearly that the shear rate...
Yeah, so if you, okay, yeah. So in this case, so here you don't see a shear band per se. I mean, this is large shear rates and you have events popping up everywhere.
But how are you applying the shear, I guess?
So this is just a simple shear in the sense that you are just shearing boundaries on top of.
This is not slot.
There is no slot. That is important. So because slot would constrain the profiles, you're asking.
It doesn't have to constrain.
Yeah.
It's really not a constraint per se. It's a
localization. Yeah. I mean, you can get the localization even if...
That's true, but without the slot, you allow for more fluctuations.
That's the cost of creating the, or the boundary.
Yeah.
So creating a transition to.
So like maybe we sort of stop now and then, well, those of us who want to come.
And have you tried any of Michael's theories?
So we have been discussing and we haven't progressed yet, but.
The curve looks very similar.
Yeah, yeah.
Yeah, so I can show, maybe in the discussion, I can show like preliminary data we have, looking at shear bands and some other systems, but. And we can talk about the mathematics of the shear band.
Where, I'm confused, and I probably didn't follow the earlier stages of the presentation. It's my bad time of day. How does this differ from the numerical models that you started with, what, 20 years ago?
Yeah, yeah. So I mean, the last half of the presentation that I gave last week, there we're doing analogous simulations really on a copper zirconium system, and doing the MD, and at the same time implementing using Chris Rycroft's code those exact constitutive relations. Yeah. And in if we use a reasonable coarse graining, we can see a reasonable correspondence between those. I think the constituent models actually do quite a good job of capturing the shear banding. I think there may be other, there's no stochasticity built into those equations at this point other than this, the fluctuations in the initial field. And so, I mean, one of the things that I think this work brings up is if you're in a glass that's not extremely well annealed, or you're at larger temperature, do you need to put in additional stochastic terms to capture
what happens
that you might nucleate the shear band somewhere else because of random fluctuations?
I'm trying to figure out what the where's the problem. What's the mystery about
what you're No, I think my interest is mainly figuring out, in this case, what are the transient states, and this would depend on various factors, and that's what we are trying to figure out. And I mean, since we come from a glass background, we are more interested in this dynamical heterogeneities and so on. And is shear band a dynamical heterogeneity? And then how do you progress from a quiescent glass which has zero dynamical heterogeneities or very minimal dynamical heterogeneities to the kind of a shear band? What are the transient structures and so on? So that would be something worth looking at.
But here you've got regular temperature.
Yes.
So the stuff is. Are you looking to see where the rearrangement events are occurring? Are you interested in this question of are there soft spots or?
Yes, so that is, I mean, that is, of course, that is of interest, but we haven't done anything concretely on that front. And this was something that I've been discussing with Michael.
Right, but you have been measuring the potential energy per atom, which is sort of the other, tells you something about how the structure is changing. Clearly the structure is changing in the shear band.
Yes.
That's exactly what we expect.
Yeah.
Structure changing how?
You have that slide of the potential energy per atom.
You mean like as you keep shearing anything?
Yeah, like as he shears it, right? So initially there's the black line.
So this is basically.
So the potential energy per atom fluctuates, but it's sort of, around some mean. And then he shears it, he gets the shear band. Inside the shear band, you see the potential energy per atom is significantly higher, means you must have lower bonding per atom, essentially. Mm-hmm. And then outside the shear band, you see it goes down, which could be in part the elastic, some elastic.
Or is it heat flow or something?
I don't know.
So it's just a periodic flow.
Yeah, yeah.
So it's fixed volume.
Yes.
Okay. That's probably important.
Yes.
So the one thing where I think, like, the data you showed where it seems to be growing like root strain, like diffusively, that's what we expected too, but we've been looking out to larger strains and it seems to deviate systematically from 0.5. So we're trying to understand that, why.
So this is the what, the width?
The broadening, yeah, the width of the shear band, the roof, the width of the shear band as it accommodates slip.
Didn't your?
What?
Didn't Michael's simulations do exactly that?
They broadened.
Yeah, yeah, they broadened.
We hadn't until recently, I think, looked systematically.
Yes.
I seem to remember that we even tried to explain that using the same effective temperature is diffusing.
Yes, and I think that that model may, but I think we haven't analyzed that model to know what we expect.
Yeah.
And that's what I'm trying to do now.
And we were really, I thought, not being very clever or deep about interpreting the effective temperature model of those things. I don't think we ever really pushed that as carefully as we should have.
Can I just sort of ask some naive questions because
please do. Do we need to record this?
You can unmic yourself.
Let's